It's time for Midday Edition on KPBS. From the hottest movies to the hottest food, today we're talking about arts and culture. I'm Jade Hindman with conversations that keep you informed, inspired, and make you think. San Diego chef Tara Mansood talks about her recent accolades, her culinary creations, and how she runs the kitchen.
It's a hard medium. Food is a hard medium because not only does it visually have to look good, it has to taste good also and satisfy a lot of senses. So it can be very challenging in that way.
Then a breakdown of the box office hit Sinners, plus a look at what's happening in your weekend preview. That's ahead on Midday Edition. So for the second year in a row, San Diego's own chef Tara Mansood has been named a finalist for Best Chef in California by the esteemed James Beard Awards for her work at local restaurants Anime and Le Coq. While she's known for the Filipino inspiration she infuses into her dishes, she's a culinary genius with foods from all around the globe, leaving a memorable impression on the palate of many. Chef Tara joins us now to talk about her recent accolades. Welcome back to Midday Edition.
Oh, thanks for having me again.
So glad to have you on.
Okay. One year.
And so the news of you being named a finalist again this year happened on your birthday. Congratulations on everything. I mean, how are you feeling about that right now?
The first time around was crazy. I think even more so the second time around because I'm splitting my time more between two restaurants. So when I say it's a team win, it's like even more so this year because I've been not just at Anime. So the team really pulled through and they really did a great job.
Wow, that's great. You know, we last spoke about a year ago and it was your first time as a finalist for the Beard Award and you were headed to France, I believe.
Yes, yeah.
Bring me up to speed. What did you do in France?
Oh, man. I ate everything I could. I try to immerse myself with what I could in 2 weeks, is immersing myself in the culture and the food scene, seeing what they're doing out there, eating the classics, also eating the new stuff that's going on out there, and just, trying to have fun and kind of get a little inspiration for Le Coq and see which direction we're trying to go for the restaurant.
Yeah. Do you think that trip positioned you for your success this year as well?
I think any trip I take, especially that one specifically, I really try to utilize it and for any inspiration I can. I'm very intentional when I go out to eat or anything like that. So, I think it set me up pretty well for this year, and it motivated me to really go hard on the food and what we're doing at Anime and Le Coq.
Well, this year's nomination comes from your work not only at Anime in downtown San Diego, but also at Le Coq in La Jolla. I hear that the traditional French kitchen is modeled after the military. So what's the kitchen like at Le Coq and how does it differ from the one at Anime?
I run my kitchens a little old school, a little new school. When you talked about militant, it's in brigade as far as like hierarchy of, executive chef, sous chef, all of the things. I guess we recognize it in that way. But as far as militant, there's chefs in there and there's herds. But I'm not so, I guess, strict. I'm very inclusive as far as, like collaborations. It's not just my way or the highway. But if anything, my kitchens, there's a lot of room for growth. There is a lot of discipline within the militant way, but just, to have structure and all of that. But, kitchens are kitchens.
Are they yelling, yes, chef, yes, chef? What's happening?
They are yelling, yes, chefs, but they're not scared of me. I'm not trying to, put them down or anything or, all of the negative things that you associate with the military. But, there is a lot of respect. I would hope so. I mean,
yeah.
No, I'm just kidding. But no, my team works hard and we all respect each other. And there is yes chefs and, plates and hurry up and like all of this stuff like that. Yeah. If people ask me if it's like the bear all the time and I say it to a certain extent. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, hey, it's earned. Okay.
Yeah.
It is earned. Hearing you talk about your vision for Le Coq, you really put a lot of thought in just the food, but also the approach to how you make it. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I mean, as far as creativity, I sit and simmer for a while, and I'm really intentional on how I build a plate and flavors and texture and color. It's a hard medium. Food is a hard medium because not only does it visually have to look good, it has to taste good also and satisfy a lot of senses. So it can be very challenging in that way. But I gain inspiration from anywhere. It could be a hole in the wall to a fine dining experience that I had that has 10 courses, you know. And I just take little bits of everything and then I kind of combine it into a plate where it meets our style and our dining, because we're not a course style menu. We encourage more family style menus at both restaurants because it's funner to eat that way, you know. It's like, and you get to taste a lot more things versus just three things for three courses, because by the time that you're full, committing to a whole entree. So
very true.
We really encourage sharing and, you know, tasting and getting multiple things for each course. So
What's the process like to get the attention of the James Beard Awards?
A lot of hard work, you know, a lot of perseverance, a lot of, you know, just pushing against the grain. I think we as a group, especially me, we stay true to who we are and our values and what I like to do, which is a lot of community work and collaborating with other chefs and just talking about food and really pushing Filipino food at Anime and then Le Coq, just having a little more fun with French food, being traditional but also a little not, having some California influences in there, and being an Asian American kid growing up in California, whatever that comes out of me is, it comes out on a plate.
Well, how does your Filipino identity play into your approach to cooking?
As far as like eating family style, that's like one way. They're at Le Coq, I like to say that the food is like 80% French and 20% Asian. Fitting, you know, I'll fit like maybe an Asian ingredient in there, or fish sauce in a French dish that you wouldn't normally have it in there, or utilizing some California ingredients. Like, we have spring is upon us, like all these green vegetables are here, so it's like it's just right to be able to use all of that currently. And then and just kind of like the morale and the culture of the restaurant is really reflective of how I grew up, really family oriented, a lot of sharing, making sure you take care of each other, like, you know, how I grew up, I guess you could say.
Let me say this, like, a number of Filipino American chefs right now have gotten attention from the James Beard Awards in the last few years. What do you think is behind this growing taste for Filipino food?
I think it's just our time. I think we touched on it last time where the wave is still happening and it's still growing. I think I have a lot of conversations with those chefs around the country. I think we're all just kind of doing what we want to do versus jobs that we thought we had to do. I think generationally, a lot of us are first American Asian Americans, and then almost we're in that age of second, you know, and they are growing up differently than we are. And so that openness to do other career paths, like being a chef, and those are the people who are dining at our restaurants. A lot of them are my age, and then they end up bringing their parents in. And it's just a new generation that are a lot more open to seeing where our food can go.
Wow. And so, you know, you work at two award-winning restaurants, which is pretty amazing. Do you have any challenges doing that?
There's not enough time in the day. sometimes I feel like that's my biggest challenge. You know, I wish I could split myself into two some days where my attention can be at both places at the same time. But, you know, we're doing pretty good. I have a wonderful staff. My sous chefs kill it every day. Without them, I wouldn't be able to do any of this. So, but yeah, I think I would be lying if I said it wasn't challenging, but that's kind of what I signed up for, and I knew that's something I wanted to do, and so far it's going good.
All right. Well, outside of the kitchen, there are like distinct food experiences at each of your restaurants. So can you explain what makes dining at Anime and Le Coq distinct?
Let me see. Anime is definitely more Asian forward, Asian American, I like to call it. So I say it's 80% Asian, 20% French technique or whatever. You know, anybody who's gone to culinary school, and like you said, the brigade system was made by the French and the military, inspired by the military. So a lot of our cooking techniques are French trained. And then, but my food is very much Asian, a little bit Korean, Chinese, whatever it may be. And then, you know, we have a wonderful dining room that's Art Deco theme. Anime is a play on words of Anna May Wong, who is one of the first actresses in Hollywood that was Asian. And so that's kind of how we got the name. So if you come in, it's a big grand dining room, lots of velvet. Yep, and really good music playing. It could be hip-hop and R&B one night, you know. And
I like it.
Yeah, with with really great food, and you could get yourself a really awesome cocktail and glass of wine and just sit down with some friends and have a really good time, you know. It's been really going really well, especially with James Beard from last year. And then Le Coq is, I would like to say, the French version of anime. It's a, like, 70s supper club theme. You got a little disco ball in the corner. We have vinyl playing on Fridays and Saturdays from a DJ. And then you got like burgundy velvet with a lot of art that is inspired from like these 70s Plexus books or magazines that are, you know, very sexy. And then the food I like is the opposite of anime, where it's 80% French and then 20% a little bit Asian in there. So yeah, both fun dining rooms, very grand, very big, sharing a lot of space. So there's no walls. There's just everybody sees everybody.
Yeah, quite the ambiance you created there. That's great. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about the chef community in San Diego. Do you get much time to break bread and connect about cooking?
Oh, I mean, we try to. I mean, there's a lot of events that happen. Granted, most of us are working almost every day, you know, and then Mondays on our day off, we're doing payroll or whatever, catching up on life. But when we do see each other, it's great. I think our community is growing and growing every year. And, you know, it's big but small, mm-hmm. you know. So when I actually did an event, and anybody was there, you know, and it was nice to see all of us in one room. And Chef Roberto, like, sharing love for me. I give him super props for making semifinals, because he's been working a lot and really representing for Oceanside as a whole. Mm-hmm. But yeah, our group in particular, we love to do events and collaborate with other chefs who want to have fun. You know, whether we did a crazy event for the LA fires where we had 13 different kind of burgers from different chefs.
Yeah.
And me being in San Diego, I have never seen that, you know, happen before. But we all, you know, gathered for a great cause and really did an awesome event and was hosted by our group. And everybody was very quick to say yes. So it's like everybody wants to do things, obviously within their time, because we're all running our own restaurants. But it's an awesome community to be part of. That's why I stayed. Some people thought, well, I thought I might go back to LA and continue my career out there. But, you know, I saw a lot of opportunity for growth out here. And working with the people I have, a lot of them I worked with in the industry, and now we're all running our own restaurants. So
yeah.
It's kind of like a small family, I guess you would say, a little bit.
That's wonderful. Are there any, like, challenges specific to the San Diego cooking scene?
I think pushing against the grain when it comes to like certain foods. Like, I put a lot of Filipino food on that a lot of people didn't know. Like, everybody knows the 101s of like lumpia and pancit. You know, we have a big Filipino community out here, and if you have a friend that's Filipino, there's at some point you've gotten Filipino food. Like, but, you know, putting things that aren't so popular and being like, hey, this is really good, and gaining the trust of those people to try those things, I think at first it was a challenge, because you know, compared to LA, there's much more diversity in LA as far as cuisine than there is here. And I think people want it, and I think they're waiting for it. It's just, at first they were a little scared, but now that I've gained their trust, it's like, they'll You'll eat whatever it's on the menu. So, yeah, I think that in that sense, you know, we're growing in that sense, but, like, it's still a little more limited as finding diversity as far as different types of cuisine. You know, like, there's so many China's so big, you know, and there's so many different dishes from different regions, and finding those in certain areas of San Diego are a lot more difficult, let's say, compared to New York. So, but we're getting there. We're getting there. And I think if people like me and the people, my peers who I know are really trying to push it, I think it's going to, we're going to get there soon, and people are going to have a lot of fun in the city.
That's great. And you mentioned just Chinese food. I mean, even regionally here in the U.S., it's different.
Yes.
Like St. Louis Chinese food, where I'm from, is much different than Chinese food here.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And it's, you know, and people, and then if you put something different on, it's like, well, that's not Chinese food. I'm like, well, wait
but
a second.
It is.
But where I'm from, or where this region, and, you know, and you don't want to give people a history lesson, but you just want to be like, you know what, just sit down and enjoy it and give it a try. And I think more and more we're getting that community and quote-unquote foodies coming out and, you know, really wanting more and more of it. And I think we're just wanting those people to come into our restaurants and really enjoy themselves.
Yeah. So. Well, the winners will be announced in June, and you'll be cooking at the after party for the awards. How do you approach cooking for some of the country's most renowned chefs?
No pressure.
Nervous about that?
You know, not at all. Not at all. You know, you have one bite to really show, and these people that you never know that you're going to meet again, you know. I think last year, I remember walking to that space. I'm like, what am I doing here? Like, I see these crazy chefs that I grew up watching, literally sitting in the front row behind me and then behind me and then walking up on stage. Like, it's a real experience. But, and to be feeding those people this year, not only just feeding them, but I'm feeding them Filipino food, which to me is a proud moment, you know, and I'm very excited about it. And I hope they enjoy it. I hope I have that one chance to make an impression with a lot of these folks. But, I you know, we do a great job at anime, and my team kills it. So I'm not scared. But, you know, if anything, I'm really, really excited. Yeah.
Excellent. I got to ask, what do you cook at home? is that where you try new dishes?
You know, you'd be surprised that, you know, a lot of chefs don't eat well at home. We eat one pot meals because, you know, after working a 10, 14 hour day, you don't want to do dishes after you've been doing dishes all day. I eat a lot of shin ramen with an egg, a lot of BLTs, a lot of, you know, easy meals that require not a lot of dishes that I can execute so that I can eat that quickly, take a shower, and, you know, get whatever rest I can get. I'm not like every chef. I'm sure some other chefs have time to cook, but when I, you know, during COVID and I had a break, I was cooking every day. I was cooking pho some days, whatever you felt like, where I had the energy to do it and the time, then yeah, I cooked anything under the sun, whatever I felt inspired by. But on the day-to-day work, if I can grab a burrito, I will.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
That's good.
But on my weekends off, you know, I'll, you know, maybe make some, you know, simple meals that are like kind of more nostalgic, like a lot of homey Filipino food for me and my partner. And maybe just a simple like salad, steak dinner, you know, nothing. I'm not making a Michelin dinner at home.
Okay.
Because that requires a lot of dishes and I don't want to do all this.
Understood.
Yeah.
Most of us are not, you know, holding two, you know, restaurants down like you are. And
there
are many days I don't feel like cooking at all either.
Exactly. I don't blame you. You know, working's hard, you know, and doing dishes and planning and cutting. And for me, it's like if I do maybe cutting an onion twice as fast as a normal person, but still feels very daunting when you're exhausted. So,
yeah,
I feel for you. No judgment. Yeah, we listen and we don't judge.
This is true. This is true. So everybody stay off my peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, okay? I do what I can.
I do what I can.
I totally understand. It's been such a joy to talk to you again.
Thank you.
Congratulations.
I appreciate it. And it's always great to be here. So you're always great to talk to. So
thank you. Thank you. I've been speaking with Chef Tara Monsad, the executive chef at Anime and Le Coq. Chef Tara, again, thanks for joining us. Good luck this year.
Thank you. Let's bring it home, San Diego, I hope.
Bring it home. Coming up, it's the movie everyone's talking about, Sinners.
Hey there. We heard tale of a party.
You did?
You wouldn't mind us coming in now, would you?
We hungry as dogs.
Woof, woof.
Our midday movie critics break it down when KPBS Midday Edition returns. This is KPBS Midday Edition. I'm Jade Hindman. Ryan Coogler's Sinners has been dominating the box office the last 2 weeks, and one of the reasons is that people are not just wanting to see the movie, but also wanting to see it repeatedly. And that's because the film is not just an action-packed vampire tale, but it is also a deeply personal film for Coogler, and it is packed with both history about his Southern roots and with Black culture. To unpack the film, we are gathering our midday movies critics. Welcome once again to KPBS cinema junkie Beth Accomando and Movie Wallace podcaster Yazdi Patavala. Welcome to you both.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jade.
So I have not seen this film yet. I'm super excited to see it, but I am looking forward to you all's insight. And also, what are we wearing today? What? This studio has really been turned into... a lair of sorts. Tell me.
A tomb, maybe?
Okay.
A catacomb? I don't know. Yeah. Well, you know, Sinners is a vampire film, not your typical vampire film. However, I did a Dracula haunt, and I thought it might be appropriate to bring a few items in. And, you know, just in case we're attacked, we have stakes, and a Bible and holy water don't work on Ryan Coogler's vampires, but the stakes work really well, and I do have an instruction manual about how to do that.
Okay.
And I'm blood splattered too, but that's okay.
Yep.
I'm not sure I fit the dress code for KPBS today, but it is work related.
Hey, any vampires? We're ready.
All right. We'll be prepared.
Yes. Well, let's begin with a little setup for the film. Michael B. Jordan plays twin brothers who return to 1932 Mississippi to open a juke joint. Here's the trailer.
You throwing a big event tonight? Listen here. This ain't no house party.
Y'all ready to drink? Y'all ready to sweat till y'all stink?
You want some?
You keep dancing with the devil. One day he's gonna follow you home.
We gonna kill every last one of you.
Okay, so the marketing for Sinners really sets us up for a horror film, but is it really?
Yes and no. So the thing about Ryan Coogler is he's so good at making personal films that also work as Hollywood products. In this case, it's a vampire horror action film, but it's also this very deeply personal film about his own Southern roots and about Black culture and about what it's like to live in Mississippi as a Black person in 1932. The thing is, they're also calling this Ryan Coogler's first horror film or first foray into horror. But I would say that his first movie, Fruitvale Station, which is about the death of this young Black man, a real story, a young Black man who was killed by a BART officer, that's horror. That's real world horror. And for half of Sinners, I would say it's that real world horror where we're dealing with, you know, Michael B. Jordan, as these two twin brothers, comes back. He's facing these white people who do not seem wholly trustworthy at all. And then it makes a jump halfway through to supernatural and vampires. And then it becomes a different kind of horror. And, you know, somebody who's a fan of zombies, I'm used to zombies being a blank canvas for social commentary. I'm not as used to vampires being that way, and he just mines them for everything they're worth and delivers on so many levels.
Wow. It sounds like this one does not fit neatly into any box. Yazdi, what are your thoughts? How do you describe it?
So I think the very fact that we struggle to put it in a box speaks of its ambition and how different it is. First and foremost, I think Sinners is the reason we go to the movies. It's the reason we want to sit down in a cinema seat and just be wowed. And we watch so many movies every day, and we kind of are used to just going through a mediocre movie watching experience. And every once in a while, a movie comes along which just shakes you up. And this is that movie. Every movie that Ryan Coogler has made has taken on a particular genre and kind of refracted it through the Black experience, be it Creed, which was a follow-up for the Rocky movies, or Fruitvale Station, or the Black Panther movies, which were superhero movies. And now this one, Sinners, he takes the framework of the vampire movie to say so much about the state of racism then and now.
Wow. Also, music plays a key role in the film. So let's talk about the big set piece in the middle of the film that plays out to the song I Lied to You.
Something I've been wanting to tell you for a long time. It might hurt you. Hope you don't lose your mind. Well, I was just a boy, about 8 years old. You threw me a Bible on that Mississippi road. See, I love you, Papa, you did all you could do. And they say the truth hurts, so I lied to you. Yes, I lied to you. I love the blues.
This is another reason to see it in the theater, is it's not just to see the visuals and see it in IMAX, it's to hear it, because this music, you hear that beat that's coming through, like you start to feel that coming up through your feet and up through your body. And Sammy is the one playing this music, and we're told that he plays so well that he can pierce the veil between dimensions. So what's interesting in a film like this, where there's a lot of action and other set pieces, I think most people coming out of the film will probably be talking about this big musical number. But I don't think it's a spoiler to say that this piece of music happens, and it does pierce the veil between dimensions. It conjures up an evil character. It also serves as this commentary on how music strings through Black culture. And I speak with John Jennings about the film, and he's a comic book artist, and he also talks a lot about Afrofuturism and this notion that this music is almost a way to time travel. Even though you may be in this one fixed place that you think you are, like, there's all these other time frames, past, present, future, that also exist at the same time. So I think it's really interesting for the music in this sequence to kind of do two things, which is the one, play up this role in the horror, and then this other part, which is about how music is so key to Black culture.
What do you think about it, Yazdi?
So Sinners is two movies. The first part of the movie is set in Jim Crow South, about this group of people who just want to have a good time and enjoy their music. And then the second part of the movie is the vampire bit. And this scene is the one which connects part A and part two of the movie. And not to indulge in hyperbole, but I cannot think of a movie in recent times which has used music this effectively. Mm-hmm. When this scene comes along, the movie has been going at a particular pace and it just takes off. And I had a transcendent experience when it happened. It's quite a remarkable achievement of how it's been shot, how the music is played. Coogler has used 65 millimeter film. He uses different aspect ratios. So we see a lot of mastery of the craft here to really give the audience an out-of-body experience, I think.
The first half of the film is about setting up the party, and Coogler is giving us a lot of detail about Black life in the South in 1932. But when night falls and Sammy's music pierces the veil, things change, and we get the character of Rimmick.
Hey there. We heard tale of a party.
You did?
You wouldn't mind us coming in now, would you?
We hungry as dogs.
Woof, woof.
You fellas must be the owners of this establishment.
That's right.
And you are?
We just came here to play. Here, I'll show you.
Pick poor Robin Clean. Pick poor Robin Clean. I picked his head, I picked his feet. I would have picked his body, but he wasn't fit to eat.
Let's go now.
Hadn't seen the movie, but I already know it was a mistake letting them in. It was such a mistake. So let's talk about Remick and vampires. Beth, you want to start?
Sure. So he is a fascinating character because he is both kind of the layers they give him. He can be both victim and predator. He's terrifying, but he's also absolutely seductive.
Well, in the merry month of May, from me home I started, left the girls of tune, were nearly broken-hearted, saluted Father dear.
He also uses music like Sammy. He's Irish in the film. And again, this brings up another layer because at one point he talks about the Irish being colonized by the British. And when the Irish first came over here to the U.S., you know, they were considered people of color also. So there's those layers to it. But then he talks like a preacher where he's come be part of our community, come be part of this family. And he's got this vibe like a preacher where he's pulling you in and kind of seducing you with something attractive. But he's also very scary. And he's key to the horror, the vampire horror in this film. But again, it's layered with the ideas of colonization, racism. There's so much to unpack through it. And the music, the piece that Sammy plays is key, but there's also a piece with Irish music that is as impactful. And again, you really feel the music like through your body in this film when you see it in the theater. And that's part of the experience.
Yeah. Yeah, Steve, what did you think? I mean, what do you think the music represents in this movie?
I think the movie represents, like Beth mentioned, this ability to reach outside of your circumstances, this ability to kind of get to a higher plane, which could be good and bad. It can open up your fortunes. It can open up evil forces as well. And you can see that both with the protagonists as well as with the bad guys. So Remick and has two other companions. They are exceptional musicians themselves. And they are using music to actually get away into this group of black citizens who are kind of trying to just have a good time at the juke joint in the middle of the night. And I just love that Coogler fathoms racism in all of its cruel ways as simply vampires, you know, as a form of vampirism, which is out to suck the blood out of minority culture. So there's so many ways to kind of interpret it. And Jack O'Connell, who plays Remick, is exceptional. He's equal parts like shining, shimmering scales and potent venom. I mean, there's something very snake-like about him, but you can understand why he's let in. You can see his charisma.
Yeah, this is so fascinating. I mean, this film is rich in meaning. Are there any films that you would recommend watching as companion viewing?
Yeah, so I would recommend a couple. One is A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night, which was an Iranian film which came out a few years ago. And it's a beautiful, stylish, black and white film. I mean, you seldom see, you know, the vampire aspect in Iranian cinema. But this kind of movie takes a totally different view of vampires in that the central protagonist, she's a vampire and she uses her skills to protect women in Iran against patriarchy, against the men who want to do harm. And so in this case, her being a vampire is seen as in a positive light. And we seldom see that aspect of a vampire story. The other one I would also like to bring up was the movie which was released on Christmas Day last year, which is Robert Eggers' reimagining of Nosferatu, the original F.W. Murnau film. And he does a pretty faithful homage to the original film, but there are parts of it which are different enough that anybody who is a lover of cinema, who's a lover of horror, ought to visit it. The central character of Ellen has been changed enough that she's no longer somebody to whom bad things happen. She's not just a receptacle for the vampire's desire. She is part of the desire. She summons him. So her haunting is not just a haunting by the vampire, but there's also a sexual component to it. So I really like how that movie kind of opens up some of those themes, which could not be addressed in the original film. And also the movie is just amazing to look at visually. There's these wonderful shades of blacks that he plays with during the course of the movie, and definitely worth checking out.
All right. Those are two on the list for sure. Beth, what about you? What are your suggestions?
Yes, I would go to some films from the 70s to start with. Ganja and Hess is a really interesting movie from 1973. Spike Lee remade it more recently, but it's sort of on the edge of blaxploitation, but it's a little more art house, and it deals with someone who is pierced with a sword from Africa that has like infected blood on it, and it turns him into a kind of vampiric creature. But again, it has this feeling of spanning different time frames through this, and this plays up more a religious aspect also, but there's also music, which is similar to Ryan Coogler's film. But it's a really interesting film to see, very underappreciated. And then on the more exploitation end, there's Blackula, which I know a lot of people laugh at because of the name, but it actually is kind of serious in its social messaging, because Dracula turns this African prince into a vampire. And it's, again, this twist on colonialism, and it has a bit of a, you know, a ring and a sting to it.
All right. Well, that wraps up another edition of KPBS Midday Movies. And remember, on Friday, you can watch the full Cinema Junkie video podcast of the show with an additional discussion of Sinners with authors John Jennings and David F. Walker. Beth, do you want to tease to that?
Sure. Well, John Jennings and David F. Walker are two of my favorite Cinema Junkie guests that I've had on before. They're both creators of comic books. John Jennings has adapted Octavia Butler novels for comics, and he teaches about Afrofuturism. And David Walker is the author of a comic series called Bitter Root, which has some themes that overlap with Sinners. So it was a really great discussion, and I hope you will watch and listen.
Wonderful. Well, this discussion, at least right here, has made me definitely want to go see the movie Sinners. So
yes.
I want to thank KPBS Cinema Junkie Beth Accomando and Movie Wallace podcaster Yazdi Pathavala. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Still to come, your weekend preview with Julia Dixon Evans when KPBS Midday Edition returns. Welcome back. You're listening to KPBS Midday Edition. I'm Jade Hindman. For our weekend art preview, we have design, a traditional Chinese instrument, and a children's book about houseplants. Joining me with all the details is KPBS arts reporter and host of our new podcast, The Finest, Julia Dixon Evans. Welcome, Julia.
Hey, Jade. Thanks for having me.
Always a pleasure. So first up is a big festival of art and design across the border. Tell us about Tijuana Design Week.
Yes, so it's a 3-day festival all about design, and it's kind of a sister event to the one that happens here, San Diego Design Week, every fall. There's exhibitions, there's panels, workshops, performances, and then activations, all sorts of stuff scattered across galleries, studios, businesses in Tijuana. And KPBS podcasts, Port of Entry, and The Finest, we're going to present a panel discussion on audio storytelling and narrative and podcasts. That will be 2 p.m. on Friday at the Free School of Architecture.
Very nice.
And there's a couple other things I would want to point out. There's a panel with independent publisher Ediciones Caradura. That's noon on Saturday. There's a workshop using bioindustrial byproducts, like from beer. That's at Telefonica Gastropark at 11 on Saturday. And then a series of exhibitions throughout the weekend at Vortex and Pop Gallery, and a bunch more. It's all free. It runs Friday through Sunday across Tijuana. And some of the events do require a reservation. Some of them are already at capacity. So check before you go. You can go to TijuanaDesignWeek.com and find all the programs divided by day and type.
All right. In San Diego, we happen to have a world-acclaimed expert on the traditional Chinese string instrument, the pipa. And this weekend, there's a concert where you can check it out.
Yeah, so this is with the La Jolla Symphony and Chorus, and it honors this year's winner of the Stephen Schick Prize for Acts of Musical Imagination, which is a great title for a prize.
I think so.
This year, the winner is Wu Man. She's a local composer and pipa player. She is incredibly talented and just really incredible to watch play the pipa. It's this almost like a lute, like a guitar instrument that can be strummed or plucked. And the concert includes this performance of Lei Lang's Five Seasons for Pipa and String Orchestra, performed by Wu Man. And there are two shows, 7:30 on Saturday and 2 p.m. on Sunday at Mandeville Auditorium at UCSD.
Such an interesting sound. I love that instrument. All right, City Ballet of San Diego is back on stage with a couple of beloved ballets. What can you tell us?
So this weekend, they're doing Carmen. And they'll perform Elizabeth Wistrich's choreography for the music by composer Bizet. And Wistrich first set this to ballet in 1989. It's been 8 years since they've performed it in San Diego, so it'll be great to hear it again. And they're also doing Balanchine's 1956 ballet, Divertimento No. 15, which is set to music by Mozart. And they'll have two shows at California Center for the Arts, Escondido, 8 o'clock on Saturday and 2 o'clock on Sunday afternoon.
And local author Mara Altman is doing an event this weekend at Warwick's on Sunday. Tell us about her book.
Yeah, so Mara Altman is going to be celebrating her new children's picture book. It's called A Little Shelf Love. It just came out last month, and this book is about houseplants, inspired by her own childhood growing up in her parents' nursery. And it's also about remembering to love yourself.
It's about a pothos plant, which is a green leafy vine, and she joins a new shelf of plants. And so she kind of sees how what all the other plants are doing and tries to be like them, and then until she realizes that she has badass green vines and it's just inherently her.
That was Mara Altman talking about her book to KPBS recently, and she's going to sign and discuss books on Sunday at 1. It's part of Warwick's Weekends with Locals series in La Jolla.
Yeah, and I believe I did that interview, and I have to say my daughter absolutely loved her book. She couldn't wait to see what was on the next page.
It's so cute.
It is. It's adorable. All right. There's a free performance by the Leonard Patton Trio. And I just spoke to Leonard last week on Midday Edition, and he even sang for us. Take a listen.
Softly as in the morning sunrise, the life of love comes stealing into a newborn day. Flaming with all the glow of sunrise, a burning kiss is sealing the vow that all betrays.
And in addition to being an incredible performer, Leonard Patton runs the Jazz Lounge and also performs all around town. And he's such a fixture in the local jazz scene and also just kind of exemplifies the scene.
I mean, I think in San Diego, the jazz culture, everybody who's running venues or doing programs, everybody's together collectively are creating the culture. It's not one person, one place.
So Leonard's playing a free show at the La Jolla Music Society with his trio at 4:30 on Friday. So if you can cut out of work a little early, this is a really great way to start your weekend. He is such a dynamic, such an engaging performer.
Indeed he is. All right. The beginning of May also marks the big exchange from the San Diego Museum Council. How can we participate?
So basically, if you have a membership to one of about 50 participating museums and institutions in San Diego County, you can use that to visit any of the other museums until May 18th. And some of the museums included are the New Children's Museum, the Japanese Friendship Garden, MCASD, Living Coast Discovery Center, Comic-Con Museum, and the Birch Aquarium. And some of the venues have limitations, like with the Birch Aquarium, you have to book a spot in advance online, and these generally don't include special events or films, and you don't get any other membership perks like discounts, but it is a great way to like have one membership and use it in a bunch of places. This runs from May 1st through May 18th.
And finally, do you have a live music recommendation this weekend?
I sure do, as always. So Sunday night, British indie rock band King Hannah is coming to the Soda Bar. And local Moondaddy is opening. This is the project of singer-songwriter, producer Kara Potiker. And we're listening to one of her latest singles, Waterbearer.
You can find details on these and more arts events or sign up for Julia's weekly newsletter at our website, kpbs.org. I've been speaking with KPBS arts reporter and host of the finest podcast, Julia Dixon Evans. Julia, thanks.
Thank you, Jade.
That's our show for today. I'm your host, Jade Hindman. Thanks for tuning in to Midday Edition. Be sure to have a great day on purpose, everyone.